It is 8:30, and we have with us once again live in the studios, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
And I want to start out and first off, thank everybody that sent in cards and letters for Maria Tomczyk. We, of course, mentioned last week that she probably would no longer be with the show. She's kind of in burnout mode. And but anyway, I was trying to encourage people to continue if they wanted to this week. You can keep sending in cards and letters. And we will, of course, pass those on to her. If you are interested in doing that, you can get our mailing address always off our website. But you can send those to Maria Tomczyk in care of me, Mike McCormick, here at the station, which is KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle, 113 Dexter Avenue North, Seattle, Washington, 98109.
And what's the website, in case I missed that?
Oh, the website, of course, is kexp.org. So reach us multiple ways and send those cards and letters. Keep those cards and letters coming. Well, we got plenty of news to cover, so let's begin with some national things. It would be pretty hard to have missed the fact that Alito is
going to be on the Supreme Court.
It's sure looking like that.
Yeah. The Democrats have really, really blown this. And, you know, I say this in the context of having written as soon as he was nominated 2.5 months ago that this guy was dangerous, that he was a radical, that this should be the number one priority of progressives to make sure that this guy did not get onto the Supreme Court. And nothing happened. The Democrats did not bring up that banner. There's been very little in the way of grassroots opposition to Alito compared to what there should have been. I think actually not that much more than there was for John Roberts. And I think Alito is much more dangerous. And we saw quite a bit of that this week. I mean, there was an intentional strategy by Republicans to start off the hearings by presenting a facade of it being very boring so people would tune out. Then there was the choreographed theatrics of Senator Lindsey Graham, who prepped Alito on how to handle the hearings, chastising Democrats and asking Alito in his stentorious voice, are you a bigot? And Alito's wife bursts into tears and goes running from the room. And of course, the headlines for the next day are how vicious and mean and cruel the Democrats are, that they're causing such distress to Alito's family, which, you know, has absolutely nothing to do with whether Alito is appropriate to have a lifetime position of power. The Democrats have really blown this. They should have picked one or two particular items, things like Alito's zeal for executive branch power, his intent to overturn Roe v. Wade, and just hammered on them and put the message out again and again and again that this guy is extreme, that with the presence on the court already of Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia and who am I forgetting? There's one other radical on the Supreme Court here.
I'm not sure.
Oh, John Roberts, of course, and then Anthony Kennedy, who is not quite as extreme, but he was the author of he was the author of the opinion in Bush v. Gore in 2000 that gave Bush the White House. So it kind of tells you where he's coming from. Those four existing votes on the Supreme Court, add it to Alito, you've got a majority for all kinds of things, including overturning Roe v. Wade, including the expansion of executive branch power, including siding with corporations and virtually any kind of conflict with the rights of ordinary Americans. I mean, you can just go write civil rights legislation. You can just go right down the list of things that are likely to be in trouble for the next generation because the Democrats did not put up a fight. The conservative Republicans have control of the White House, have control of the have control of Congress, at least until November, and now they're going to have control of the Supreme Court. And the Democrats let it happen, and we, the public, have also let it happen. And it's really, really quite discouraging to see, frankly.
Well, so it goes to committee, doesn't it, next week?
Yeah, it goes to committee, and then there'll be a full vote of the entire Senate before the end of the month. So, you know, virtually every count that I've seen of the senators says that Alito's gonna get it with between 57 and 62 votes. Still, there needs to be an effort because, you know, what else can you do to try and stop this? And you need cards and phone calls and faxes and office visits and emails to Senate offices, particularly moderate Republicans that might be swing votes, because even if you have every Democrat voting against Alito, that's only 44 votes, and you're going to need 51 because the Republicans will go to the nuclear option if they need to get this guy into the Supreme Court. That's how high the stakes are. The Republicans realize it. It's a shame that the Democrats don't realize it, and it's really discouraring because, as Noam Chomsky said, and when I interviewed him last month, Bush would be in serious trouble in this country if there were a real opposition party, and right now there's not.
All right, moving along, Abramoff update.
Yeah, there were several other things going on this week for the unraveling corruption scandals involving lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Alexander Strategy Group, which was the lobby shop that was set up by former Tom DeLay chief of staff Edwin Burkham, went out of business this week due to the bad publicity from Abramoff. Alexander Strategy Group got some more bad publicity. They were up to their necks in the Duke Cunningham bribery scandal, and they also had hired Christine DeLay for $115,000 to tell Alexander Strategy Group what the favorite charity of each member of Congress was. And when you look at the Abramoff scandal and you look at how charities and nonprofits were used by some of these Congress people to launder money, to funnel campaign donations that were otherwise illegal, you can see why that would be really useful information. It wasn't just make work kind of stuff, although I don't know why you need $115,000 to pick up the phone and make some phone calls. The other thing that came out this week that was really interesting was Charles Hurwitz, according to a report in the Los Angeles Times. That may be a familiar name. He is the CEO and president, I believe, of Maxim Corporation, which, among other things, owns Kaiser Aluminum, which locked out aluminum workers in Tacoma and Spokane and then closed down those plants a few years ago. Also owns Georgia-Pacific, which has been the target of environmentalists for many years for clear-cutting old-growth redwoods in Northern California. Well, it turns out that Hurwitz... there was an attempt in the mid and late 90s to save some of the old growth at Headwaters and other areas in Northern California by swapping it out for money that Hurwitz owed to the federal government out of the SNL scandal. He owned the largest of the SNLs that went belly up in the late 80s, for people who remember that particular scandal, and cost taxpayers literally billions of dollars. Hurwitz owned one that was worth over $1 billion in taxpayer money that he owed, and the FDIC was investigating Hurwitz. Well, it turned out that DeLay, along with Richard Pombo and John Doolittle, a couple of his trained poodles, both from the state of California, basically took donations from Hurwitz, and then turned around and pressured the FDIC to kill the investigation. And when the FDIC didn't roll over, they did a remarkable thing. They convened hearings, subpoenaed the case that the FDIC investigators were assembling against Hurwitz, and then read it into the congressional record, meaning that Hurwitz had access to everything that the FDIC had on him, which basically killed the investigation. I mean, it was a remarkable abuse of power that took place. And this, again, is another scandal that just points up the culture of corruption that's happened under Republicans in Washington, D.C. So, and involved Tom DeLay, involved a lot of the same circle of people. Of course, Doolittle is up to his neck in the Abramoff scandal. His wife was another spouse that was hired by Alexander Strategy Group, in fact. So that that happened also. And then there's been more shooting back and forth around whether Patty Murray should return the $50,000 that she's gotten from Jack Abramoff. She is the second leading Democrat in Congress in terms of money taken from Abramoff, primarily because she's on The Senate Appropriations Committee, and Danny Westneat had a column in the Seattle Times, and David Goldstein, who I usually agree with, also had a thing on horsesass.org, basically defending Murray and saying that the money came from Abramoff's clients, Native American groups. It was completely legal. Why not take money from the tribes? They didn't do anything illegal, and that's really not the point. The point is that Abramoff had been using his clients to funnel money to congressional people that he wanted favors from, and we do not know what the quid pro quo for that money was, whether it actually came from tribes, whether it actually came from Abramoff. You know, there's the appearance of impropriety there, and that's why Murray needs to return the money. But at the same time, you've got a lot of Republican spinmeisters saying this is a bipartisan scandal. It's not a bipartisan scandal. Abramoff, of course, did give money to Democrats, but the bulk of the money, the huge chunks of the money, went to Republicans. The quid pro quo was almost all with Republicans. This is a Republican scandal, and we're going to see Bob Nye and John Doolittle and probably quite a few other Republican legislators go down in 2006 because of it.
All right, moving along, the NSA scandal has some updates as well.
Yeah, we learned a few more things that were this week interesting this week. I mentioned last week that there was a report in October of 2001 saying that the NSA had destroyed the names of thousands of Americans that it had already spied upon. This is 1 month after 9/11, and that there was another report saying that spying began immediately after 9/11. Now, this is months before Bush had said that the spying program began in early 2002, and the executive order that that allowed for it, saying that you know, even if his rationale that as a wartime president he had the authority to override a law of Congress would fly, and there are a lot of people who think it's illegal. I think it's illegal, but even if you said that didn't excuse the. The spying that began immediately after 9/11. Well, it turns out that the reason the NSA had thousands of names that it could destroy in October of 2001 was that the spying did not begin right after 9/11. It began right after Bush was inaugurated in January of 2001. There was a report that came out that was declassified and came to light this week, is something called a Transition 2001, talking about the transition team when Bush first took power, and in 2001, saying that the NSA began its warrantless domestic spying literally right after the inauguration. Now, this should be a huge news story, and for some reason it has not made headlines at all. But this scandal goes back to the first days of the Bush administration, that they overturned a lot of the regulations and a lot of the procedures for NSA spying on American citizens in the days after Bush took office in 2001. So this scandal is not just about the war on terror, because it predates the war on terror. It's not just about 2001 and tracking al-Qaeda, because again, it predates 2001. There were a couple of other things that came up this week. A report in the Baltimore Sun that the NSA was using Baltimore City Police to spy on the Baltimore Pledge of Resistance, a peace group in Baltimore that was holding regular protests outside the Fort Meade, Maryland headquarters of the NSA, that the NSA was, again, spying on American citizens and then using Baltimore City Police to conduct direct face-to-face surveillance in addition to the NSA monitoring phone calls and emails and such. And then we also had a report this week that Russell Tice came forward as one of the NSA employees who leaked the story of NSA spying to the New York Times a little over a year ago in fall of 2004. If you remember, the New York Times actually sat on the story all the way through the presidential election and for another year after that until December of 2005. If this scandal had come out in October of 2004, it could have swung the election. The New York Times gave a second term to George Bush, which is just, you know, nobody's come up with a reasonable explanation as to why the New York Times acted the way it did. But in any event, Russell Tice came forward, said he was one of the NSA employees, a longtime 20-year employee, insider, who came forward, leaked the story because he thought it was illegal. And what wasn't didn't make as many headlines is that Tice was actually demoted and then fired by the NSA in May of 2005, long before the story was printed by the New York Times. He lost his security clearance because presumably of the leak. So this is a guy who's lost his livelihood, lost his job because he stood up for what he believed was right. And then the New York Times still sat on the story for another 6 months. So there you go.
So I guess that makes the New York Times a member of the Pioneer Club.
Yeah, it does. But as we all know, and as Bill O'Reilly keeps harping, the New York Times is a charter member of the so-called liberal media.
Yeah, the Pioneer Club being the people who raise $100,000 or more for
George Bush, you know, his reelection.
There was another club too. I can't remember what it was for the $200,000 mark. But all right. Well,
the Boys Club.
Yeah. Sticking with national, the IRS has been busy.
Yeah, a couple interesting stories. Speaking of the New York Times this week, David K. Johnston, who's their tax and IRS expert, came up with two stories in one day, which really were quite instructive in their contrast. One of them was that the IRS has frozen the refunds of million poor people, that the refunds, which don't add up to that much money, were frozen so that the IRS could investigate whether the refunds were being, and the tax credits were being claimed fraudulently. Now, this is even though fraudulent claims by lower income people only amount to $9 billion in cost to the IRS in a given year, compared to $100 billion for people who underreport their income or get income out of the cash economy. But the IRS isn't focusing on that. They're focusing on the poor. And at the same time, under the Bush administration, we had the report this week by David K. Johnston that the IRS has gone back on a court order that they've had to implement every year since 1976 for a professor who was originally at the University of Washington here in Seattle, but is now at Syracuse University, a woman named Susan Long, who had won a court order against the IRS in the 1970s, requiring them to give her the information as to how often and to what extent the IRS audits the tax returns of the very wealthy and of corporate America. And then Professor Long would turn around and publish that information publicly for the public to see. Well, this has happened again every year for the last 25, 26, 27 years or so. This year, the IRS stopped giving her the information and said, well, we don't have any record that court order exists. And then, of course, Long gives her the chapter and verse of where, you know, the actual court order, because she still has it. And the IRS says, well, we don't know about that. We will have to go research it. So the IRS is refusing to give out that information, which is, you know, part and parcel with the Bush administration's sort of refusal to give out government information and refuse FOIA requests and essentially have a culture of secrecy. This is something that the Bush administration, the executive branch, has tried to push every single button that it can to try and get away with over the last 5 years, and especially in the last year or two. And they're trying it now with the IRS also, while, you know, hiding the amount of accountability there is in the system for the very wealthy, while at the same time freezing the refunds of the very poor. It's very instructive as to their priorities.
All right, moving along, the Interior Department were busy beavers this week as well.
Yeah, folks remember that there was a huge battle in Congress a few weeks ago that Senator Murray Cantwell was instrumental in, to stop oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Well, just west of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is another pristine area of about equal size called the National Petroleum Reserve. Now, this is an area that was set aside many decades ago. I believe it was in the 1910s originally. It's been a long time in any case. That was set aside for essentially emergency use. That they've known that. That can't have been that long, but the people have known that there have been oil reserves there for many years. But they're setting it aside for some time when an OPEC oil embargo or something like that, when it's really needed. And because it's been set aside land for so long, and because it was wilderness before that, it's also a huge wildlife refuge where there's enormous waterfowl and herds and so forth. Well, very quietly this week, the Interior Department announced that 500,000 acres of the National Petroleum Reserve, which is a huge chunk of land, it's something like three times the size of the state of that's wrong. Anyway, it's a very large amount of land, was going to be pulled out of the petroleum reserve and used for oil drilling. And this is something that they're doing by essentially by regulatory order. It doesn't have to go through Congress, and there's been very, very little publicity about it. A lot of the tribes on the North Slope of Alaska are really upset about this, but outside the state of Alaska, it's gotten very, very little publicity, and it's every bit as much of an environmental bad thing as drilling Anwar would be.
All right, moving along, CAFTA ran into a little problem this week.
Yeah, not just this week, but if folks remember, the Central American Free Trade Agreement was narrowly passed by Congress last year. It took a lot of arm twisting by the White House and by Tom DeLay's appointed thugs to get it to pass. They overcame a lot of opposition, particularly in the House of Representatives, to a new free trade agreement that linked the United States and all six of the Central American countries. Well, the CAFTA was supposed to go into effect January 1st. And it turns out the CAFTA did not go into effect January 1st. And the reason it didn't go into effect was that the United States is now pressuring these six Central American countries to change their domestic laws to favor United States-based pharmaceutical companies and prevent consumers in Central American countries from having as free an access to cheap drugs, particularly generics. The dispute is over the length of time for which Big Pharma will have exclusive patents on their formulas, as opposed to being able to have generic drugs. And this is not just about Central America. What Big Pharma and the United States government, the Bush administration, are trying to do is set a precedent for future bilateral trade agreements with much larger countries to try and get a much longer period of exclusivity for the various pills that Big Pharma is pushing, and to prevent people and these mind you are fairly poor third world countries, to prevent people from having access to generic drugs. And this is going to cost lives, and it's something that the United States government is pushing very hard when obviously they don't have to, when the World Trade Agreement the World Trade Organization and the World Health Organization have already reached agreement on access of third world countries to generic drugs, and these Central American countries are already in accord with those standards. The United States basically wants to raise the standards. This is yet another reason, why people in the global South hate America. And it's certainly not the only reason, and it's unfortunately been a pretty consistent pattern of behavior by the U.S. government, but this one is pretty despicable.
Well, you combine that with the new Medicare plans kicking in now too. It's pretty hard to find people that are very happy about Big Pharma.
Well, I'm actually on Medicare and trying to figure out which of the different 47 plans in Washington State is the right plan for me. It's a nightmare system. It's a very, very bad system. And the way it's set up, you have to there's literally a penalty for every month after May 15th, which is the filing deadline. You have to pick a plan by then. Every month thereafter, for the rest of your life, the cost goes up by 1% if you don't join and you're eligible to. So I mean, after a couple of years, that becomes very, very expensive. So they're really pushing people to get into these privatized plans, and it's bad news.
Pushers. All right, just a few minutes left. Guantanamo, there was some more revelations came out this week.
Yeah, Amnesty International had another report on Guantanamo this week. A prisoner there, Saudi Arabian national named Jamal El-Dasari, I hope I'm getting that right, Jamal El-Dasari, who is still a prisoner in Guantanamo, in fact, he's one of the hunger strikers there, wrote an account, which I actually posted on the blog at Eat the State, eatthestate.org. Just click on the ETS blog link on the right, and it'll take you right to it. A really harrowing account by this gentleman of what he's gone through since he was first seized by the Pakistani army and then sold to the Americans shortly thereafter and taken to Guantanamo in 2002. He's been at Guantanamo for 4 years. He's both experienced personally and witnessed all kinds of torture, all kinds of degradation, urinating on the Quran, all sorts of other things. According to Amnesty, his accounts have been corroborated both by other prisoners there and by representatives of the International Red Cross who've been the only people who've been allowed to visit Guantanamo. This is harrowing stuff, and it again puts the lie to the Bush administration claim that we do not torture. We do torture, and we've done it repeatedly. And this isn't just a rendition to third countries that practice torture, where we hand the prisoners over knowing full well what will happen to them. This is stuff that happens when prisoners are in American custody. And it's an outrage. It really is. And if anybody wants to wants to have an uncomfortable breakfast, go to that account and read it, because it's very instructive as to how your tax dollars are being used.
All right, and bouncing back closer to home, I was surprised to see that we have a couple King County Council people that are pushing for citizen oversight with the sheriff.
Yeah, Julia Patterson and Bob Ferguson on County Council, both Democrats, went Sheriff Sue Rahr one further this week. Rahr proposed a blue ribbon panel to look at all the various problems that have been plaguing the King County Sheriff's Office. Well, Patterson and Ferguson have instead proposed citizen review boards, specifically two different ones, actually. One of them an independent auditor that would look at internal investigations, and then beyond that, a three-person panel that would field complaints from the public about the behavior of individual officers. This is something that the Officers Guild for the King County Sheriffs, the King County Police Officers Guild, is almost certainly going to fight. But Democrats have a majority on County Council. We know Larry Gossett is behind this. It only needs two other votes, and hopefully we'll get some citizen oversight for the sheriff's office. This is great news.
I don't know. I think it's about an even battle there between a police guild and elected officials.
Yeah, that's very true. It also underscores Bob Ferguson being one of the people who is pushing this. He was in a very tough battle with another incumbent, Carolyn Edmonds, last November. And Edmonds is much more of the sort of milquetoast Democrat, along with Larry Phillips, who inexplicably is going to be county council chair again this year. She very rarely did anything, and this is another evidence why Ferguson was the right choice in that race.
All right, and quickly, Monday, the event big events?
Yeah, Martin Luther King Day. I've got another essay up on workingforchange.com about how we do and don't use the legacy of Martin Luther King. Once again this year, there will be what really passes for the closest thing that progressives have to an annual convention in this city, the Martin Luther King Day celebration at Garfield High School, 23rd and Jefferson. There are workshops from 9:30 to 11. Then there's a rally at 11. And at noon, people gather in March. So folks should go and check it out. 9:30, a chance to get some good organizing type workshops, and then a march in memory of Martin Luther King and all that he stood for.
Very good. Talking once again with Joe Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where can people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. Volunteers put it together about new global and local news. A lot of the things that you've heard me rattle right through over the last half hour. Anywhere you find free publications is where you will find Eat the State. Bookstores, cafes, all kinds of places like that. You can also find it on the web. The website is www.eatthestate.org, all one word. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you'd like to volunteer, you have feedback, our voicemail, very easy to get a hold of, area code 206-719-6947.